Joining me today is Professor Smith from the University of Essex. Hello, Professor.
Hello.
And he's written a book, The Russian Revolution, A Very Short Introduction. How long did it take you to write this?
Well, actually, a very short time. I was under pressure from my publisher to get it out quick. So normally I write fairly slowly, but this took me probably about 6 to 8 months to write. But I was doing other things at the same time.
Okay. And where did your fascination come from? We're assuming that you have a fascination for the Russian Revolution or Russian studies. Where did that interest come from?
Well, I've been teaching for over 20 years, and Russia has been my main interest in that period. I became very interested in Russia, I suppose, by reading Russian novels, and mainly in my teens. And I also got an interest in the Russian language while I was still at school. And then when I was at university, I was very interested in left politics, in the world in the early 70s, and I suppose it was fairly inevitable that when I decided what to concentrate my research on, it was going to be the Russian Revolution, and it all sort of went from there, really.
Okay. And how did you choose, because this is a condensed version of history, how did you choose what goes into this version of history?
Well, that's a very, very interesting question. A lot of very short books, and that actually isn't quite as short as it should have been. It's about 50,000 words, but a lot of books of that length would concentrate very much on a political narrative, on explaining who the major political figures were, how the state collapsed in late imperial Russia, and how a new state was born. I definitely didn't want to do that. I wanted to try and write a book which gave people some understanding of what the revolution meant for ordinary people, the impact of revolution on society, on the economy, on cultural patterns, and so on. At the same time, since we're dealing with a revolution, we are, of course, dealing with power, with politics, and so politics had to be pretty much at the forefront. But the problem of trying to write briefly was that I was trying to encompass a very, very large range of different issues. So it was really quite hard, for example, to talk about the impact of the revolution on young people or the revolution on the arts, as well as the struggle between Trotsky and Stalin in the 1920s, which would be the sort of thing that a lot of people would focus on the grounds that that was really rather more important in the long term than young people seeing the revolution as an opportunity to get back at their parents or to reject religion or to experiment with sex or whatever.
Exactly. We do get a wide array of sort of anthropological view of how the revolution occurred. How did we're obviously talking about the 1917 revolution, and so how did this revolution, what elements were in place to foster such a revolution in Russia at the time?
Well, again, I tried to do something which may not have worked, and that is to pay less attention to the roots of the revolution, the background to the revolution, and more to how the revolution developed in the course of the First World War and in 1917. And my reason for doing that was because, although I think one can trace the roots of the crisis of Tsarist Russia way back, certainly as far back as 1861 when the Tsarist government finally emancipated the serfs, my own feeling is that this was certainly a pretty rickety political system and a society that was in trouble. But revolution was not somehow inscribed in the fortunes of the imperial system. For me, the crunch came with the First World War. And therefore, I wanted to perhaps spend less time talking about the deep-rooted problems and of Imperial Russia, and instead to give a sense of how the First World War proved to be the straw that broke the camel's back. The First World War led to the collapse of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, the collapse of the Turkish Ottoman Empire, arguably led to the collapse of Germany or German Empire. And certainly for Russia, it was one burden too many. And at that point, the system collapsed. That said, I don't want to suggest that Russia under Nicholas II was, in any sense, a soundly organized society. There were very, very deep problems, particularly in the countryside. Over three-quarters of the population were peasants. They were extremely poor. Agriculture was extremely backward. Secondly, the system, the Tsarist government, was trying to gradually modernize this system. It was aware that it was backward economically and particularly militarily backward. And so what it was trying to do was to gradually modernize society from above, to encourage industry, to encourage schooling, to gradually try and reform agriculture. But all the time, it was aware that in doing this, it was unleashing forces that might actually lead to the collapse of the system. So all the time, there was a very strong commitment to preserving political order, to preserving stability. And so as peasants came to the cities, they were crowded into terrible slums. The factories were extremely oppressive. They worked long hours for very, very low wages. And so from the end of the 19th century, you begin to see the rise of working class unrest and so forth. And the response of the authorities is always, in the first instance, to suppress unrest, to bring in the police, to bring in the Cossacks. And this creates a situation, not where I think revolution is inevitable, but where there is a considerable potential for instability and conflict. But as I say, it's only really with the crushing burdens of the First World War that this system collapses. And it does so really, I think, for a combination of economic reasons and political disillusionment. Society ceases to believe that the government can actually conduct the war efficiently, and it withdraws its support.
I guess one of the things that I enjoyed the most about the book was particular emphasis on all the different nationalities in Russia, and really a focus on nationalism and self-determination. And
right.
In Russia, we often mention or refer to Russia as this like one nation, sort of unified. We have this idea of it being a unified country. Can you expand a bit about how such a revolution could have been organized in such a vast territory and with so many different nationalities?
Sure. I mean, I don't take any credit for this, but I think it's only really since the collapse of the Soviet system when the nationalities issue was really quite an important one in the course of the process of collapse itself that historians have begun to give proper due attention to the fact that the Russian and some would say the Soviet Union were empires. They were multinational states in which the bulk of power was enjoyed by the Russians. But the Russians, certainly in the early part of the 20th century, were not a majority. The Russians probably were about 45% of the Russian Empire. At the time of the First World War, there were other Slav groups like the Ukrainians, but Russia was also a vast area in which there were people like Muslims in Central Asia, or Georgians and Armenians in the Caucasus, or the different peoples of the Baltic and so on. So this was a real patchwork of different ethnic groups. In some ways, the problem of nationalism was surprisingly unimportant in bringing about the collapse of the Russian regime in 1917. Nationalism on the part of non-Russian peoples had been becoming a problem in the course of the first 10 years of the 20th century. But the war, in some senses, both aggravated the problem, but also drew people's attentions to more pressing problems of economic kind. And so when the Tsar collapsed, many thought that in some ways the national problem would be solved, that it was a relatively secondary problem, that with a democratic government it would be possible to bring the non-Russian peoples into some harmony with their Russian counterparts. And that actually proved to be a very, very wrong-headed prediction, because as Russia democratized in 1917, in fact, this encouraged nationalists, mainly middle-class, educated people, to press for greater autonomy within their regions. And in many respects, it was the refusal of the new provisional government, a democratic government led by Prime Minister Kerensky, which in some ways was responsible for pushing the nationalists further and further into a position where they were effectively demanding full-scale separation from the Russian polity. Nationalism in some ways was still quite weak in 1917, so the revolution didn't see very, very strong nationalist movements anywhere in Russia, possibly in, say, Georgia, which had a very, very long history and where there are various odd reasons, social and national conflicts tended to work together. But elsewhere, national movements found themselves very, very internally divided, and particularly where nationalist leaders were not prepared to take up peasant demands, where they weren't willing to support peasant demands to expropriate the landowner class and give land to the peasantry, then they quickly found themselves marginalized. So in the course of 1917, I think it's still probably fair to say that nationalism remains a relatively secondary issue and that it proves quite hard to organize around that. In the Civil War, as the Russian state disintegrates, then you see, I think, a paradox. On the one hand, the desire to see non-Russian peoples form their own political communities becomes stronger, and yet at the same time, in the very, very devastating circumstances of civil war, where all kinds of conflicts mesh with one another, the weakness of nationalism is it continues to be exposed, and the Bolsheviks, curiously, are the beneficiaries of that, because often nationalists, faced with the choice of a lesser of two or three or four evils, in the end opt for the Bolsheviks, not because they are very, very keen on the Bolsheviks' vision of socialism, but rather because they think, in some senses rightly, that the Bolsheviks will give them a better deal than, say, the whites or the Poles or others, who, like the Turks, who are involved in various ways in the national conflicts of the Civil War.
That's another issue I'm fascinated with, another group, the Bolsheviks, because as I understand it, they didn't have necessarily the majority of the support in Russia, but throughout they're the ones that spearhead many of the revolutionary actions, whereas some of the other groups, some of the other political groups, bring about very important ideas, but we tend to focus on the Bolsheviks when we think about the Russian Revolution.
Yes, that's right. I think it's wrong to write the history of the revolution in terms of the Bolsheviks, at least until October 1917, because the Bolsheviks were a rather insignificant, not completely insignificant, but a rather insignificant force in late Imperial Russia. They'd emerged in 1903 when they split with the Mensheviks, and they did so over the question of the kind of party that revolutionaries should form in order to bring about revolution. And whereas the Mensheviks were very much influenced by Western European socialism and believed in the importance of organizing workers through trade unions, pressing for reforms through parliament and so forth, the Bolsheviks were always a revolutionary party in the sense that they had little time for parliamentarism. They believed certainly that the Russian autocracy had to be overthrown by force, and they believed that although the working class and poor peasants would be the agent that would overthrow the regime, they believed that without a party leading them, their energies, their revolutionary militancy would be squandered. And so from the first, from 1903, when they split from the Mensheviks, the Bolsheviks, led by Lenin, were associated with this idea of the revolutionary party, the idea that a party must lead, must give consciousness, must give vision to the struggles of workers and the poor peasants. Because they were the most militant of the various groups, and there were many pressing for either reform or revolution in Imperial Russia, they were always under the watchful eye of the police. And during the years up to the First World War and during the war, they suffered very, very heavily from police persecution. Many of them were exiled, others were put in jail. And consequently, when the Tsarist regime was overthrown in February 1917, the Bolsheviks were in disarray. They were divided. Their numbers were very depleted. Lenin was in exile in Switzerland. And in the course of 1917, they remain, until the summer at least, somewhat on the margins. They are perceived to be now rather out of tune with the new democratic Russia. And as you say, other parties are very much in the forefront. The biggest of the parties in 1917 by far is a party called the Socialist Revolutionary Party. And they trace their ancestry back into the 19th century to those who believed that the peasants were the force for revolutionary change, who believed that Russia might be able to avoid some of the excesses of capitalist development in Western Europe and move directly from this backward Tsarist society into some kind of peasant socialism. And although they were a very, very diverse party in 1917, their kinds of politics, which were broad and inclusive, which were democratic, although they supported the war certainly, these were very, very much in tune with the feelings of the people. Only as it became clear that the provisional government was not going to bring Russia out of the war, only as it became clear that the provisional government was not about to expropriate the landlords, only as the provisional government faced a deepening economic crisis did ordinary working people, mainly workers and soldiers, fewer peasants, only then did they begin to shift support away from the center towards the radical Bolshevik left. And as people may well know, the Bolsheviks appealed to ordinary people in very, very simple ways. They were absolutely opposed to the war. So they called for down with the war, for an immediate peace. They called for bread, peace, and land, slogans with a great appeal as Russian townsfolk began to find themselves faced with bread shortages and so on. And finally, and perhaps most interestingly, they called for power to go to Soviets. And Soviets were essentially committees of workers, committees of soldiers, which had appeared first of all in 1905 when Russia had had an unsuccessful revolution, but which quickly reemerged after February 1917. And for Lenin in particular, these Soviets represented a much higher form of democracy, as he put it, than parliamentary institutions, because they were rooted in the masses. They were elected and accountable, elected by and accountable to working people. And so when the Bolsheviks came to power, the expectation was, and this was shared by many in the leadership of the party, that Russia would actually become not a highly centralized and authoritarian society, but one in which power would actually be decentralized, distributed into local communities. And this, I think, accounts for much of the appeal of the Bolsheviks at this time. You're right, of course, this was not a majority. the best, the highest level of support that the Bolsheviks got, probably, was in November 1917 when elections took place for the first time in Russia. And in those elections, the Bolsheviks got rather less than a quarter of the vote. But significantly, in towns and cities, in barracks and at the front, they did rather well. And it was using soldiers, using workers, that they were able to impose themselves on local Soviets throughout the country. And once they promised land to the peasants, which they the provisional government had been very, very reluctant to support, then they gained, only very briefly, but they gained some support from the peasants too. So there was a moment when the Bolsheviks could be said to have had a significant degree of popular support, but they never had a democratic mandate in the parliamentary sense.
I'd like to go back to the war briefly. You mentioned that the First World War was instrumental in the revolution and in the downfall of the Tsarist regime. And there was afterwards another war, a civil war in Russia, that was also instrumental in shaping further policies. You mentioned that the Soviets were meant at the beginning to be a non-authoritarian regime, but the civil war seems to have perhaps shaped the culture, the party, the Bolshevik party culture, into something else. Can you maybe explain how that happened?
Yes, absolutely right. I think that at the beginning of the 21st century, we have to try and imagine ourselves back into the second decade of the 20th century. It's very easy for us, living in prosperous and stable and democratic societies, to throw up our hands in horror, particularly at some of the more appalling things that the Bolsheviks did in the Civil War, forgetting that our own governments at that time, perhaps Canada less than Britain, but Canadian soldiers were certainly very involved in the First World War, but forgetting that governments like the British government, the German government, the French government were involved in the most hideous slaughter between 1914 and 1918. And particularly for Russia, which effectively was a losing belligerent in the First World War, the consequences were very, very severe, not just in terms of the way the Bolshevik regime came to power, but also severe consequences in terms of the inability of democratic forces to try and establish more stable, more inclusive institutions in 1917. The Bolsheviks, having come to power with some considerable support, expected that some kind of civil war would be on the cards, but civil war for them really meant class struggle. They expected that their efforts to expropriate landowners and capitalists would necessarily provoke resistance, that there would be military conflict as part of that. Yet as early as February 1918, Lenin is saying the civil war is over. We've had the resistance from the former ruling classes. They're now defeated. Now we all go on to build a socialism. But of course, it didn't work out like that. The war was still going on. Germany was able to invade large areas of the former empire and to, in some senses, hold the Bolsheviks to ransom. And the white forces, as they became, the opponents of the Bolsheviks, were given a breathing space and some support from the Allies in putting together an army that was capable of putting up very, very stiff resistance to the Reds. And so a very, very brutalized and brutal civil war got underway. And as you say, this had very severe consequences, long-term consequences, arguably, for the shape of the regime. In the first place, the army became the backbone of the new order, in the sense that workers in 1917 and Soviets may have been a key base for the Bolsheviks, but they quickly became sidelined by the much more powerful Red Army. Secondly, the popular organizations that had developed in 1917 quickly fell apart under the impact of economic crisis and effectively economic collapse. Industry more or less collapses. Many townsfolk are forced out of the towns back into the villages. Thirdly, the Civil War leads to big changes in the Bolshevik Party itself. The party had been never a kind of democratic political party, but it had been a relatively open party. In the course of the Civil War, it becomes more and more a centralist, authoritarian party that rules by virtue of the tight-knit oligarchy at the head of the party. All wars lead to centralization to some extent. This is true in democratic states as well as in Russia in the Civil War. But in the case of Soviet Russia, an extreme form of centralism ensued. And the culture of the party changed. The culture of the party that had once been fairly open, fairly democratic, loose-knit sort of party in touch with its grassroots, that starts to give way to a much more militarized party, one where members behave like soldiers, taking orders from on high, and then behaving towards the rest of the population rather like soldiers of an occupied country. And so by the end of the Civil War, you'd already got very, very considerable culture of authoritarianism. And really a society that was held together by little more than a very, very effective but very, very centralist party backed by an army.
My last question is, what is the relevance of the Russian Revolution today, and what can it teach us about revolutions? Are revolutions doomed to become autocratic?
Those are big questions. I think at some level we can see now that the Russian Revolution, or one might say the Chinese Revolution and the revolution in Korea and so forth, in some senses they were cul-de-sacs. They have now effectively run out of steam. And looking back over the 20th century, we can see that many of the expectations that communism was the wave of the future proved to be wrong. Communist revolutions, as you say, ended in forms of grotesque tyranny and new forms of inequality. And to that extent, I think there's very little to be learnt for contemporary politics by looking at the ideology, the forms of organization, the forms of politics of these regimes. I think we have learnt that any politics worth its salt is worth its name has to be democratic. On the other hand, and this is where I would urge us all to stand back and reflect on our own values, we live in a time when people have lost confidence in politics, where politics has ceased to be about very much. And yet, we live in a world where there are still massive issues of grave importance facing humanity, whether we think about staggering inequalities in the world today or the ways in which states resort to war in order to solve international problems, or whether we think about the possible ecological disaster that faces our planet. In other words, there are still massive issues out there. And I think thinking back to revolutions in the 20th century, we can see that though they got their politics horribly wrong, in some senses, their belief in politics, the belief that politics was the key to creating new kinds of human communities, that belief, I think, is still as relevant today as it was back in the early part of the 20th century. Moreover, I think that looking back at the revolutions, we should sort of see that revolutions are not some kind of mass pathology. They don't occur because whole populations become sort of obsessed and become crazed and irrational. revolutions have their roots in deep, deep social, economic, and political problems. And in many parts of the world, problems as severe as those that led to revolutions in the 20th century still persist. And so I think we have to recognize that politics and politicians in our own democratic societies have to enlarge their visions. They have to engage with a much more radical agenda, perhaps, than most of us are used to in the course of elections and normal politics. So in that sense, I think that revolutions alert us to the structured injustices that exist in the world today, but they also perhaps have something to tell us about the deficiencies of our own political systems and our own political leaders, all of which have become very, very unwilling to confront issues that might lead to conflict, issues that might lead to perhaps a more vigorous political debate than the one we're used to.
Well, thank you very much for this wonderful condensed version of the Russian Revolution, and thank you very much for joining us today, Professor Smith.
Thank you very much indeed for the opportunity. I've loved it.
My words to you, you bloodthirsty beast. You intruded into the ranks of the revolution and did not allow the Constituent Assembly to meet. You said, down with prisons, down with shootings, down with soldiering. Let wage workers be secure. In a word, you promised heaps of gold and a heavenly existence. And the people felt the revolution began to breathe easily. We were allowed to meet, to say what we liked, fearing nothing. And then you, bloodsucker, appeared and took away freedom from the people. Instead of turning prisons into schools, they're full of innocent victims. Instead of forbidding shootings, you've organized a terror, and thousands of people are shot mercilessly every day. You've brought industry to a halt so that workers are starving, the people are without shoes or clothes. Letter from a Red Army soldier to Lenin, the 25th of December, 1918. From The Russian Revolution, a very short introduction by S.A. Smith.